Richard had one and only one goal in life, and that was to attend Portsmouth High School, play sports, get a car, get a girlfriend, and go to the drive-in.
I don't want to be here. I want to be in Tampa. I want to play baseball, chomp down on hot dogs, and watch the Beverly Hillbillies.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Henkin.
And this week on the podcast, two stories about boys who'll do anything and everything to get kicked out of boarding school and sent home.
So this first story is from Richard Meltzer, who at the time was the principal or head of the lab school, Baltimore. And he told this for an incredible crowd at Baltimore Center Stage Theater. Take a listen.
In the spring of 1959, in a small town in southern Ohio called Portsmouth, lived the Meltzer family. Son Richard, age 15, and his mother and father. Richard had one and only one goal in life, and that was to attend Portsmouth High School, play sports, get a car, get a girlfriend, and go to the drive-in. Unfortunately, in 1959, the Russians launched a series of satellites. It also somehow disturbed my parents because they suddenly felt that Portsmouth High School was not the proper place for me, that I deserved a better education. So, in the fall of 1959, I am whisked off to Hebron Academy in Hebron, Maine, founded in 1803, a private school for young males whose goal is to go Ivy League. I wore a sports jacket, tweed from Brooks Brothers, khakis, bass Weegians with the pennies in them, and a ubiquitous slide rule, which began in my inside breast pocket and extended out into my chest, which somehow resembled a phallus with numbers on it. To this day, I still have no idea how the damn thing works. During this time, this fall, I was doing okay in school. I noticed that the letters from my father, the handwriting began to change, and my mother called and said that my dad, wasn't feeling well. I go home at Christmas time, the Christmas break, and I discover that he is seriously ill. I ask my mom, geez, I think you need me here. I don't want to go back to Hebron Academy. Let me just, go back and return to high school. No, you need to go back. That's your father's and my wish. So I go back. The end of February, actually February 26, 1960, I'm called over to the headmaster's office. The giant man with a bald head, glasses, always seemed to wear camel hair jackets and this really ugly bow tie. He always smoked a pipe. He sits me down and tells me that my father had died. The smoke from the pipe just somehow, like a giant metaphor, just kind of goes into my lungs and I just become numb. So I leave, go back to Ohio, attend the funeral, once again decide, aha, let me ask if I can go back to Portsmouth High School. The answer from my mother is no, and it was your father's wish for you to, do well at Hebron and go on and do all these different things. I now go back and I have a plan. I'm going to get myself kicked out. Let me tell you what happens. I didn't do any homework. I didn't study. I failed every test I possibly could. And all I got from the teachers was empathy. The last thing that I wanted. I wanted Fs. I couldn't get an F to save my ass. They labeled me fragile. Today I'd have been labeled emotionally disturbed, but I guess fragile, being in special ed, emotionally disturbed isn't a good label. Fragile is much better. Anyhow, I end up with all these D minuses, and I'm invited back. My plan is blown up. So I return for my junior year. Now I'm smarter. It's guerrilla warfare. The state of Maine Department of Motor Vehicles at that time, you could write to them and they would send you blank driver's licenses. Don't ask me why. I had a whole pack of them. Prior to the Kennedy half dollars, they had the Liberty had 50-cent pieces, which they basically had the same kind of logo as the State of Maine symbol. So you just take that, you take a piece of paper, take a hammer, we'd sell them for $5 a piece. It was great. We also were able to dig a hole in our closet in our dorm room. We were able to crawl across and go down and drop in all the different teacher apartments, you know, take their food, move all the furniture around. Not only could I not get F's, I still couldn't get caught. No one ever worked so hard to try to get to public high school like I did. One night, we break into the kitchen, into the school walk-in. You know what walk-ins are? They're big giant refrigerators with a big wooden door. And we're in there. There are four of us, and we're eating cold chicken croquettes and chocolate pudding with our hands. Because God forbid you'd want to bring utensils when you've broken into a big refrigerator. Anyhow, I see a flashlight, and suddenly my three friends disappear. And a night watchman comes in, and I go, next thing I know, in my most violent moment of my life, there is this frying pan-like thing. I pick it up, and I swing, and I hit him with it. And his last word, not his last word ever, he did... He did recover to testify against me, actually. But his last word as he fell was Meltzer. So, the next morning I'm back in the headmaster's office. Same outfit, he's got the camel hair, the ugly bow tie and everything else. Same pipe, same smoke, but the smoke this time was going back in his face because I had been expelled. I was so happy. Then we had to call home to my mom. This was a part of the plan I really hadn't figured out. So she's hysterical. I think she's wrapped the telephone cord around her body or something. I'm not sure what. But I try to say, now can I go back to high school? And she says, no way. So you do what any wise 16-year-old would do then. You know, the winter time in Maine. You pack a little bag with what you have, and then you head on down the road. And somebody picked me up. I took a bus to New York City and lived kind of, the current word is homeless. I would like to say I learned the New York subway system for a while. Turned myself into my grandmother later on after about 2 months, and then was given the choice whether to attend military school or the U.S. Marines. I chose military school, and that is a whole different story, but I'll save that. I just want to end by saying I think through all these different experiences and ultimately the chances that I got and, you know, the education that it's led me to what I do now in giving kids, especially kids with learning disabilities, second, third, and even fourth chances. Thank you for listening.
I love this story. I feel like it feels like a movie. Like it feels so of its era and just a kid who's just trying to do anything to get kicked out, and then the fact that these people,
they
want to help him. Yeah.
they have empathy for him, and it's not to his advantage. Yeah, it's a really sweet story and very funny. Before we get to our next story, we're going to take a quick break.
Support for WIPR's podcasts comes from Catholic Charities. Celebrating its centennial in 2023, Catholic Charities is the largest private provider of social services in Maryland. Learn more about this movement to change lives at cc-md.org.
This next storyteller, Abe Wasserberger, shared this at a recent fundraiser for a local synagogue, and it is very similar to Richard's. They are of the same era.
Yeah. Men of a certain age.
Yeah. And especially there'll be a television show that Abe references throughout. that drives very much home what era he came up in. So take a listen to Abe's story.
We're going to take a little journey. It starts in 1962. Who remembers 1962? John Glenn, first American to circle the earth. The Bee Gees were hot. The number one rated TV show was the Beverly Hillbillies. If you remember that tonight, you're in for a treat. In 1962, I'm 10 years old. My parents are Holocaust survivors from Poland, living and raising me and my three siblings in Tampa, Florida. How many of you have ever been to Tampa? Well, back in 1962, it wasn't as crowded, didn't have as many tall buildings, but it was beautifully sun-drenched, Clearwater Beach with white quartz sand. It was a great place to grow up as a child. My father started a cabinet business. He was a dentist by trade in his town of Krakow, Poland, but there's no reciprocity in the United States. So what does a dentist do with his hands? He builds cabinets. He started a cabinet shop that grew and ultimately became the leading manufacturer of store fixtures for the drugstore and department store trade. Mom stayed at home and raised me and my three siblings. As Dad's business grew, his fortune grew. And as his fortune grew, people would line up to ask him for money. My parents used to call them schnorrers. How many of you have heard that term? Some think the term means a beggar. Some think the term means somebody that's asking for money. In today's PC, it's a fundraiser. No one came more often through the plant to ask for money on a regular basis than the black hat, black coat, Chabad Lubavitch rabbis. They must have come 2-3 times a month, always making a beeline to his office. And I'm sure Dad always cut a nice check because they always kept coming back. Somehow, they convinced my parents that little A.B. was going to be the next great rabbi for America. And for a certain sum of money and a commitment to send me to the yeshiva in Brooklyn, they could make that happen. Well, shortly thereafter, I'm on a train to cold, dark, busy, dirty Brooklyn. And I'm in a cold, dark, dirty yeshiva building filled with men in black hats, long gray beards, black coats, and tons of pale white kids in wrinkly shirts. The building smelled like rotten eggs wrapped in BO. Every Sunday morning, the chief rabbi called me into his office. He's sitting across from an expansive desk with a long gray beard, big glasses. He's looking at me. Was Herzog? That means, what's happening in Yiddish? Was Herzog? Well, what's happening? What's happening is, I don't want to be here. I want to be in Tampa. I want to play baseball, chomp down on hot dogs, and watch the Beverly Hillbillies. Why am I here, Rabbi? You, little A.B., are here because Hashem has shined his face upon you. You are a blessing to your family, who has lost so much in the Shoah. They are alive today because of you. Now, that's a Jewish guilt sandwich. That's hard to swallow. So while he was saying this, I'm thinking of beautiful Tampa. I'm thinking of hot dogs, which I still love to this day, right? In the back of my mind, the theme song to the Beverly Hillbillies. You know it. Come listen to a story about a man named Jed, a poor mountaineer who barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting for some food, and up from the ground come a bubbling crude. Oil, that is, Texas tea. Well, the first thing you know, okay, I'll go. Jed's a millionaire, blah, 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 blah. Beverly Hillbillies, swimming pools, movie stars. That was the image I had until I heard again, Vus Erza. Okay, Rabbi, I'm not Rabbi material. I don't like davening all day. I don't like being around these smelly kids. I don't like you. I want to go home. What's it going to take? I get dismissed, you know, with a mean look. I'm sitting on my bed, contemplating the great escape. And I remember Huckleberry Finn. Huckleberry Finn, who escaped an abusive father by getting on a raft and floating down the Mississippi. But I'm in frickin' Brooklyn. But I can still escape. So I start a soft escape on a Tuesday. After Mincha and Maariv, I grab an apple and I run out the front door and I'm hiding in the corner. After a couple hours, I'm cold and scared. No one's looking for me. I come back in. It's like I was invisible. I try this two more times, same result. At this point, I am sitting on my bed again, wondering, maybe God wants me here. Or maybe I'm not trying hard enough. So it's Shabbat. And what happens on Shabbat in a yeshiva? Not a hell of a lot. No electricity, no elevator, no car, no TV, no radio, no elevator, no intercom. If I escape, they won't know where I am and they won't come after me. And it'll drive them freaking crazy. So I left after services and hid behind a big tall mailbox, looking and waiting to see black hats run out of the yeshiva for me. Soon enough, someone comes by, grabs me by my just growing payas, like this, drags me across the street, dumps me in the foyer of the yeshiva. Later, I learned they called that the hair dance. Well, that just made me more angry. And I did that two more Shabbatot, ran across the street, and I stayed out longer each successive Shabbat, from early morning till after Havdalah, until after dark. By that time, when I walked into the yeshiva, I was the most hated kid in the school. Success! I figured, they're going to kick me so hard, I'm going to fly from New York and land in Tampa. That next Sunday, I'm in the chief rabbi's office, and he hands me the phone. It's my father. You are no longer going to be in the yeshiva, he said. But you're not coming home either. You're going to live the rest of the school year with your bubby and Zeta on their chicken farm in Vineland, New Jersey. Mom, Dad, there's got to be some mistake. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be in Vineland. I don't want to be with chickens. I want to be with you, with my brother, with my sisters, with my friends, playing baseball, watching the Beverly Hillbillies, and having a hot dog. Son, you're an embarrassment to the family. Everyone in Tampa thought you were going to be the next great rabbi. Now you've been kicked out of the best yeshiva in the country. You're going to have to stay the remainder of the school year with your bubby and Sadie. I'm now in Vineland, New Jersey, on their chicken farm. Now, my bubby and Zeta are also Polish immigrants, Holocaust survivors. They spoke Russian, Polish, Hebrew, Yiddish, and maybe 10 words of English. They had no car, no radio, no TV. They knew nothing about a 10-year-old or the potential antics that I would bring to the family. But I loved them, and they loved me. I didn't want to do anything to hurt them. But I knew eventually I would need to escape. how would I do it in such a way that wouldn't hurt them? Let me tell you about my grandmother and grandfather. Grandpa was tall, probably where I got my height. He was strong. He was a tailor by profession in Europe. When he got angry, he thrashed around the house, yelling in multiple languages. When Bubby got upset, she was short, stout, dressed in a house dress all day and a babushka. When she got angry, maybe it was reflux, but she would have this belch, this mournful belch that sounded like this. Bleh! Bleh! Bubby belched often. Well, Tuesday came. I knew what I had to do. I wanted it to be soft. And so I came home from school, fixed the sandwich, went into the tall grass across the street. I'm looking to see if they're going to come for me. It's dark. I come into the house. There's a dinner waiting for me on the table, and they're already in the bedroom asleep. Next morning, I'm waiting to see if they're going to say anything. Nothing. I did this two more times. Dinner's on the table. They're asleep. They didn't notice a thing. Now I'm getting worried that I'm going to have to pull the nuclear option, the Shabbat option. I didn't want to hurt them. So I figured I would plead with my parents one more time. It's after Shabbat, I'm on the phone. Mom, Dad, please let me come home. Nope. You know, you're an embarrassment, blah, blah, blah. You got to work it out. After the year, no one will remember. You'll come home. We'll be fine. Mom, Dad, you know, Zeta is sick. He has a heart condition. And Bubby is losing her sight. And God forbid, if I have to pull the nuclear option and Zeta has a heart attack, it's going to be on you. Don't do it, they said. Well, at first Shabbat that I could, I went into the tall grass with my sandwich and waited to see if they would come and look. And the moment I saw that, I was going to spring out because I didn't want to prolong it. Second Shabbat, I don't see anyone. I come back in the house. They're upset. They're looking at me. They're speaking all these different languages. But they didn't say anything. I'm on the phone with my father. I hear you've been away. Yes, you better send me to Tampa. No, you're not coming to Tampa. So I knew the last Shabbat, I was going to have to make this gut-wrenching. I was going to leave at the crack of dawn so they wouldn't know where I was. And I wasn't going to come back until late at night. Again, they had no one to call. They had nowhere to go but sit and enjoy the chaos that little AB was bringing. I'm in the tall grass, and I see my Bubby in her little house dress and her babushka coming out like this. Abiyaso! Kimahaim, come home. Bleh. I was heartbroken. I couldn't continue. I came out of the weeds. I gave her a hug, and we walked into the house, and there was dinner. My grandfather comes running into the kitchen with his belt outstretched. Bubby inserts herself in between us to shield me from his tirade. Years later, they made Aliyah to Israel. They moved to Israel. Grandpa suffered a fatal heart attack while yelling at the pharmacist for not filling his prescription fast enough. Bubby lost her sight and moved into a nursing home in the very Orthodox section of Meir Shearim in Jerusalem. It's 1982. I go to see her. Bubby, it's Abiyosel. Whack! I'm sure I deserve that. And what happened to little AB? Little AB went to law school, and then he went to Yeshiva University, where he got his master's degree, and became, with a specialty in fundraising administration, and became a professional schnorrer.
When I was working with him on this story, it was over Zoom, and he's like, I haven't told this story in a very, very, very long time. And so he goes on to share the story, and then he started crying.
Wow.
He's like, I cannot believe I'm crying.
Which part was upsetting him?
Just that he wanted to go home. Yeah. He missed his home so much.
So young.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Oh my God. Yeah. Both these men were like consummate raconteurs, and it was such a pleasure to listen to them that you could almost forget like both these boys were hurting, you know? And yeah, it was really wonderful.
All right. Well, so thank you so much for listening to this installment of the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast.
We want to thank Maureen Harvey, who produces the podcast. We want to let you know that at stoopstorytelling.com, you can find information about upcoming shows. In fact, there's a show coming up on Wednesday, May 8th, Mother Love, Stories of Being a Mom, Caring for a Mom, and Loving Even the Unlovable Moms. So you can get information on that. You can listen to stories. And we want to thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time with more stories from The Stoop.